arrested and what Mr. Mackenzie, the lawyer, said I should say, and what I did not say even to him, and what I said at the trial, and what I said afterwards, which was different as well, and what McDermott said I said, and what the others said I must have said, for there are always those that will supply you with speeches of their own and put them right into your mouth for you, too. And that sort are like the magicians who can throw their voice at fairs and shows, and you are just their wooden doll. And that's what it was like at the trial. I was there in the box of the dock, but I might as well have been made of cloth, and stuffed, with a china head. And I was shut up inside that doll of myself, and my true voice could not get out. I said I remembered some of the things I did, but there are other things they said I did, which I said I could not remember at all. Did he say, I saw you outside at night in your nightgown in the moonlight? Did he say, who were you looking for? Was it a man? Did he say, I pay good wages, but I want good service in return? Did he say, do not worry, I will not tell your mistress, it will be our secret? Did he say, you are a good girl? He might have said that. Or I might have been asleep. Did she say, don't think I don't know what you've been up to? Did she say, I will pay you your wages on Saturday and then you can be gone out of here and that will be the end of it and good riddance? Yes, she did say that. Was I crouching behind the kitchen door after that, crying? Did he take me in his arms? Did I let him do it? Did he say, Grace, why are you crying? Did I say I wished she was dead? Oh, no. Surely I did not say that, or not out loud. And I did not really wish her dead. I only wished her elsewhere, which was the same thing she wished for me. Did I push him away? Did he say, I will soon make you think better of me? Did he say, I will tell you a secret if you promise to keep it, and if you do not, your life will not be worth a straw? It might have happened. I'm trying to remember what Mr. Kinnear looked like, so I can tell Dr. Jordan about him. He was always kind to me, or so I will say. But I can't rightly remember. The truth is that despite everything I once thought about him, he has faded. He's been fading year by year, like a dress washed over and over, and now what is left of him? A faint pattern, a button or two. Sometimes a voice. But no eyes, no mouth. What did he really look like when he was in the flesh? Nobody wrote it down, not even in the newspapers. They told all about McDermott and about me as well and our looks and appearance, but not about Mr. Kinnear because it is more important to be a murderess than the one murdered. You were more stared at then. And now he's gone. I think of him, asleep and dreaming in his bed in the morning when I bring in his tea, with his face hidden by the tumbled sheet. In the darkness here I can see other things, but I can't see him at all. I tell over his pieces, counting. The gold snuff box, the telescope, the pocket compass, the penknife, the gold watch, the silver spoons that I polished, the candlesticks with the family crest, I live in hope, the tartan vest. I don't know where they have gone. I'm lying on the hard and narrow bed, on the mattress made of coarse ticking, which is what they call the covering of a mattress. Though why do they call it that, as it is not a clock? The mattress is filled with dry straw that crackles like a fire when I turn over, and when I shift it whispers to me, hush, hush. It's dark as a stone in this room and hot as a roasting heart. If you stare into the darkness with your eyes open, you are sure to see something after a time. I hope it will not be flowers. But this is the time they like to grow, the red flowers, the shining red peonies, which are like satin, which are like splashes of paint. The soil for them is emptiness. It is empty space and silence. I whisper, "Talk to me," because I would rather have talking than the slow gardening that takes place in silence with the red satin petals dripping down the wall. I think I sleep. I'm in the back passage, feeling my way along the wall. I can scarcely see the wallpaper. It used to be green. Here are the stairs going up. Here's the banister. The bedroom door is half open, and I can listen. Bare feet on the red flower carpet. I know you're hiding from me. Come out at once, or I'll have to find you and catch you, and when I've got hold of you, then who knows what I will do. I'm keeping very still behind the door. I can hear my own heart. Oh, no. Oh, no. Oh, no. Here I come. I am coming now. You never obey me. You never do what I say, you dirty girl. Now you will have to be punished. It is not my fault. What can I do now? Where can I turn? You must unlock the door. You must open the window. You must let me in. Oh, look. Oh, look at all the spilt petals. What have you done? I think I sleep. I'm outside, at night. There are the trees, there's the pathway, and the snake fence with half a moon shining, and my bare feet on the gravel. But when I come around to the front of the house, the sun is just going down. And the white pillars of the house are pink, and the white peonies are glowing red in the fading light. My hands are numb, I can't feel the ends of my fingers. There's the smell of fresh meat, coming up from the ground and all around, although I told the butcher we wanted none. On the palm of my hand, there's a disaster. I must have been born with it. I carry it with me wherever I go. When he touched me, the bad luck came off on him. I think I sleep. I wake up at cockcrow and I know where I am. I'm in the parlor. I'm in the scullery. I'm in the cellar. I'm in my cell under the coarse prison blanket which I lightly hemmed myself. We make everything we wear or use here, awake or asleep. So I have made this bed, and now I am lying in it. It is morning and time to get up. And today I must go on with the story, or the story must go on with me, carrying me inside it, along the track it must travel, straight to the end, weeping like a train, and deaf, and single-eyed, and locked tight shut, although I hurl myself against the walls of it, and scream, and cry, and beg to God himself to let me out. When you are in the middle of a story, it isn't a story at all, but only a confusion. A dark roaring. A blindness. A wreckage of shattered glass and splintered wood, like a house in a whirlwind, or else a boat crushed by the icebergs or swept over the rapids, and all aboard powerless to stop it. It's only afterwards that it becomes anything like a story at all, when you are telling it to yourself or to someone else. From the governor's wife, Simon accepts a cup of tea. He doesn't much like tea, but considers it a social duty to drink it in this country, and to greet all jokes about the Boston Tea Party, of which there have been too many, with an aloof but indulgent smile. His indisposition appears to have passed. Today he's feeling better, although in need of sleep. He's managed to get through his little talk to the Tuesday group and feels he's acquitted himself well enough. He began with a plea for the reform of mental asylums, too many of which remain the dens of squalor and iniquity they'd been in the last century. This was well received. He then continued with some remarks about the intellectual turmoil in this field of study and about the contending schools of thought among alienists. First, he dealt with the material school. Such practitioners held that mental disturbances were organic in origin, due, for instance, to lesions of the nerves and brain, or hereditary conditions of a definable kind, such as epilepsy, or to catching diseases, including those that are sexually transmitted. He was elliptical here, considering the presence of ladies, but everyone knew what he meant. Next, he described the approach of the mental school, which believed in causes that were much harder to isolate. How to measure the effects of shock, For example, how to diagnose amnesias with no discernible physical manifestation, or certain inexplicable and radical alterations of the personality. What, he asked them, was the role played by the will, and what by the soul? Here Mrs. Quesnel leaned forward, only to lean back when he said he did not know. Next he proceeded to the many new discoveries which were being made, Dr. Laycock's bromide therapy for epileptics, for example, which had put paid to a great many erroneous beliefs and superstitions, the investigation of the structure of the brain, the use of drugs in both the induction and the alleviation of hallucinations of various sorts. Pioneer work was constantly going forward. Here he would like to mention the courageous Dr. Charcot of Paris, who had recently dedicated himself to the study of hysterics and the investigation of dreams as a key to diagnosis and their relation to amnesia, to which he himself hoped in time to make a modest contribution. All of these theories were in the early stages of their development, but much might soon be expected of them. As the eminent French philosopher and scientist Maine de Biran had said, there was an inner new world to be discovered, for which one must plunge into the subterranean caverns of the soul. The 19th century, he concluded, would be to the study of mind what the 18th had been to the study of matter, an age of enlightenment. He was proud to be part of such a major advance in knowledge, if only in a very small and humble way. He wished it was not so damnably hot and humid. He was drenched by the time he concluded, and is still conscious of a marshy smell which comes from his hands. It must be the digging. He'd done another spell of it this morning before the heat of the day. The Tuesday group applauded politely, and Reverend Verringer thanked him. Dr. Jordan, he said, was to be congratulated upon the edifying remarks with which he had honored them today. He had given them all a great deal to think about. The universe was indeed a mysterious place, but God had blessed man with a mind, the better to understand whatever mysteries were truly within his comprehension. He implied that there were others which weren't. This seemed to please everyone. Afterwards, Simon was thanked individually. Mrs. Quesnel told him he'd spoken with heartfelt sensibility, which made him feel slightly guilty, as his chief goal had been to get the occasion over with as quickly as possible. Lydia, very fetching in a crisp and rustling summer ensemble, was breathless in her praise, and as admiring as any man might wish, but he could not shake the notion that she hadn't really understood a single word he'd said. "Most intriguing," says Jerome Dupont now at Simon's elbow. "I notice you said nothing about prostitution, which, along with drink, is surely one of the major social ills afflicting our age." "I did not wish to bring it in," says Simon, "considering the company." "Naturally enough. I would be interested in your opinion of the view held by some of our European colleagues that the penchant for it is a form of insanity. They link it to hysteria and neurasthenia." "I am aware of it," says Simon, smiling. In his student days, he used to argue that if a woman has no other course open to her but starvation, prostitution, or throwing herself from a bridge, then surely the prostitute, who has shown the most tenacious instinct for self-preservation, should be considered stronger and saner than her frailer and no longer living sisters. One couldn't have it both ways, he'd point out. If women are seduced and abandoned, they're supposed to go mad. But if they survive and seduce in their turn, then they were mad to begin with. He'd said that it seemed to him a dubious piece of reasoning, which got him the reputation either of a cynic or of a puritanical hypocrite, depending on his audience. "I myself," says Dr. Dupont, "tend to place prostitution in the same class as the homicidal and religious manias. All may be considered, perhaps, as an impulse to play-act which has run out of control. Such things have been observed in the theatre among actors who claim that they become the character they are acting. Female opera singers are especially prone to it. There's a Lucia on record who actually did kill her lover. It's an interesting possibility, says Simon. You do not commit yourself, says Dr. DuPont, gazing at Simon with his dark, lustrous eyes. But you will go so far as to admit that women in general have a more fragile nervous organization, and consequently a greater suggestibility? Perhaps, says Simon. Certainly it is generally believed. It makes them, for instance, a good deal easier to hypnotize. Ah, thinks Simon. Each to his own hobby horse. Now he's getting to it. How is your fair patient, if I may call her that? Says Dr. DuPont. Are you making progress? Nothing definitive yet, says Simon. There are several possible lines of inquiry which I hope to follow up. I would be honored if you would permit me to try my own method, just as a sort of experiment, a demonstration, if you like. I am at a crucial point, says Simon. He doesn't wish to appear rude, but he does not want this man interfering. Grace is his territory. He must repel poachers. It might upset her and undo weeks of careful preparation. At your convenience, says Dr. DuPont. I expect to remain here for another month at least. I should be pleased to be of help. You are staying with Mrs. Quesnel, I believe, says Simon. A most generous hostess, but infatuated with the spiritualists, as are many these days. An entirely groundless system, I assure you. But then the bereaved are so easily imposed upon. Simon refrains from saying that he doesn't need any assurance. You have attended some of her evenings, should I call them seances? One or two. I am, after all, a guest. And the delusions involved are of considerable interest to the clinical inquirer. But she is far from closing her mind to science and is even prepared to fund legitimate research. Ah, says Simon. She would like me to attempt a session of neurohypnosis with Miss Marks, says Dr. DuPont blandly, on behalf of the committee. You would have no objection. Curse them all, thinks Simon. They must be getting impatient with me. They think I'm taking too long, but if they meddle too much, they will upset the apple cart and ruin everything. Why can't they leave me to my own devices? Today is the Tuesday meeting, and as Dr. Jordan is speaking at it, I did not see him in the afternoon since he had to prepare. The governor's wife asked if I could be spared for a little extra time, as they were short hands and she would like me to help with the refreshments, as I have often done. Of course, it was a request in form only, as Matron had to say yes, and did so, and I was to take my supper in the kitchen after, just like a real servant, as the supper at the penitentiary would be over by the time I got back. I was looking forward to it, as it would be like the old times when I was free to come and go, and there was more variety in my days and such treats to look forward to. I knew, however, that I'd have to put up with some slights and hard looks and spiteful remarks as to my character, not from Clary, who has always been a friend to me, although a silent one, and not from Cook, who is used to me by now. But one of the upstairs maids resents me, as I have been in this house longer and know its ways, and enjoy the confidence of Miss Lydia and Miss Marianne, which she does not. And she is bound to make some allusion to murders or strangling or some such distasteful thing. Also, there is Dora, who has been coming in to help with the laundry, but not permanent and only paid by the hour. She is a large person with strong arms and useful for the carrying of the heavy baskets of wet sheets, but untrustworthy, as she is always telling tales of her former mistress and master, who she says never paid what they owed her, and carried on in scandalous ways besides, with him so far gone with drink he was no better than an imbecile, and blackened his wife's eye for her more than once, and her taking sick at the drop of a hat, and Dora wouldn't be surprised to find there was drink at the bottom of her vapors and headaches as well. But although Dora says all these things, she has accepted to go back there, and to be the maid of all work again, and indeed has already begun, and when Cook asked her why she would do it, considering they're such disreputable people, She gave a wink and said that money talks, and loudly too, and that the young doctor who boards there has paid out her back wages and begged almost upon his bended knee to have her back, as no one else was to be found. And he is a man who likes his peace and quiet and for things to be clean and tidy and is willing to pay for it, although the landlady cannot, her husband having run off on her, so that now she was no more than a grass widow, and a pauper at that. And Dora says she won't take orders from her any more, as she was always a carping and peevish mistress, but only from Dr. Jordan, as he who pays the piper calls the tune. Not that he is up to any good either, she says, having the air of a poisoner about him, as so many doctors do have, with their bottles and potions and pills. And she thanks the good Lord every day that she isn't a rich old lady under his care, or she would not be long for this world. And he has a strange habit of digging in the garden, although it is now much too late to plant anything. But he goes at it like Sexton, and has turned over almost the whole of the yard none the less, and then it's her who has to sweep up the mud he tracks in, and scrub the dirt out of his shirts in the wash, and heat up the water for his bath. I was astonished to realize that this Dr. Jordan she was talking about was the same one as my Dr. Jordan. But I was curious as well, for I hadn't known all those things about his landlady, or indeed anything about her at all. So I asked Dora what sort of woman was she, and Dora said, "Skinny as a rail and pale as a corpse, with long hair so yellow it was almost white, but despite that and her fine lady ways, no better than she should be, although Dora did not yet have the proof of it. But this Mrs. Humphrey had a wild rolling to the eye and a twitchy manner, and those two things together always meant warm work behind closed doors. And that Dr. Jordan should watch himself, because if ever she saw a determination to get a man's trousers off him, it was there in the eyes of Mrs. Humphrey. And they took breakfast together every morning now, which to her mind was unnatural, which I thought was coarse, at least the part about the trousers. And I think to myself, if that is what she says about those she works for behind their backs, then, Grace, what will she say of you? I catch her looking me over with her small pink eyes, and devising what sensational tale she will tell her friends, if any, about taking her tea with a celebrated murderess, who ought by rights to have been strung up long since and cut into slabs by the doctors like butchers dressing a carcass, and what was left of me after they'd finished, done up into a bundle, just like a suet pudding, and left to moulder in a dishonoured grave with nothing growing on it but thistles and nettles. But I am all for keeping the peace, and so I say nothing, for if I was to get into a fight with her, I know sure enough who would be blamed." We had orders to keep our ears open for the end of the meeting, which would be signaled by applause, and a speech to thank Dr. Jordan for his edifying remarks, which is what they say to everyone who speaks on these occasions. And that would be our signal to bring up the refreshments. And so one of the maids was told to listen at the parlor door. Down she came after a while and said the thanks were being given. And so we counted to 20, and then sent up the first urn of tea and the first trays of cakes. I was kept below, cutting up the pound cake and arranging it on a round platter, for which the governor's wife had given instructions that there was to be a rose or two in the center, and very nice it looked. Then word came down that I was to bring in that particular plate myself, which I found odd. But I tidied my hair, and carried the pound cake up the stairs, and in through the parlor door, expecting no harm. There, amongst the others, was Mrs. Quesnel, with her hair like a powder puff, wearing pink muslin, which was far too young for her, and the governor's wife in grey, and Reverend Verringer looking down his nose as usual, and Dr. Jordan, somewhat wan and limp, as if his talk had worn him out, and Miss Lydia in the dress I'd helped her with, and pretty as a picture she was. But who should I see, looking straight at me with a little smile, but Jeremiah the peddler? He was considerably trimmed as to hair and beard, and got up like a gentleman in a beautifully cut sand-coloured suit, with a gold watch-chain across the vest, and holding a cup of tea in the best mincing gentleman's manner, just as he used to when imitating the same in the kitchen at Mrs. Alderman Parkinson's. But I'd have known him anywhere. I was so taken aback that I gave a little shriek, and then stood stock still, with my mouth open like a haddock, and almost dropped the plate, and indeed several pieces of the pound cake slid off it onto the floor, and the roses as well. But not before Jeremiah had set down his cup and laid his forefinger alongside his nose, as if scratching it, which I don't believe anyone saw, as they were all looking at me, by which gesture of his I knew that I was to button my lip and not say anything or give him away. So I did not, but excused myself for dropping the cake, and set the platter on the side table and knelt down to retrieve the spilled cake into my apron. But the governor's wife said, "Never mind that at present, Grace. I wish to introduce you to someone." Then she took me by the arm and led me forward. "This is Dr. Jerome Dupont," she said. "He is a noted medical practitioner." And Jeremiah nodded to me and said, "How do you do, Miss Marks?" I was still confused, but managed to keep my composure. The governor's wife saying to him, "She is often startled by strangers," and to me, "Dr. Dupont is a friend. He will not hurt you." At which I nearly laughed out loud, but instead said, "Yes, ma'am," and looked down at the floor. She must have feared a repetition of that other time when the head-measuring doctor came here and I screamed so much, but she need not have worried. "I must look into her eyes," said Jeremiah. "It is often an indication as to whether or not the procedure will be efficacious." And he lifted my chin, and we gazed at each other. "Very good," he said, all solemn and sedate, just as if he was what he pretended to be, and I had to admire him. Then he said, "Grace, have you ever been hypnotized?" And he kept hold of my chin for a moment to steady me and give me time to control myself. "I should certainly hope not, sir," I said with some indignation. "I do not even know rightly what it is." "It is an entirely scientific procedure," he said. "Would you be willing to try it? If it would help your friends and the committee, if it is decided by them that you should." And he gave my chin a little squeeze and moved his eyes up and down very quickly to signal to me that I should say yes. "I will do anything within my power, sir," I said, "if that is what is wanted." "Good, good," he said, just as pompous as a real doctor. "But in order for it to be successful, you must repose your trust in me. Do you think you can do that, Grace?" Reverend Verringer and Miss Lydia and Mrs. Quinnell and the governor's wife were all beaming at me with encouragement. "I will try, sir," I said. Then Dr. Jordan stepped up and said he thought I'd had enough excitement for one day and care must be taken of my nerves, as they were delicate and must not be damaged. And Jeremiah said, "Of course, of course." But he looked well pleased with himself. And although I have an esteem for Dr. Jordan and he has been kind to me, I thought he looked a poor fish beside Jeremiah, like a man at a fair who's had his pocket picked, but does not yet know it. As for me, I could have laughed with glee, for Jeremiah had done a conjuring trick, as surely as if he'd pulled a coin from my ear or made believe to swallow a fork. And just as he used to do such tricks in full view, with everyone looking on but unable to detect him, he had done the same here, and had made a pact with me under their very eyes, and they were none the wiser. But then I recalled that he'd once travelled about as a mesmerist, and done medical clairvoyance at fairs, and really did know the arts of such things, and might put me into a trance. And that brought me up short, and gave me pause to consider. "It is not the question of your guilt or innocence that concerns me," says Simon. "I am a doctor, not a judge. I simply wish to know what you yourself can actually remember." They have come at last to the murders. He's reviewed all the documents at his disposal, the accounts of the trial, the opinions of the newspapers, the confessions, even Mrs. Moody's overblown rendition. He is fully prepared, and also tense. How he conducts himself today will determine whether Grace will at last crack open, revealing her hoarded treasures, or whether she will instead take fright and hide, and shut herself up like a clam. What he's brought with him today is not a vegetable. Instead, it's a silver candlestick, supplied by Reverend Verringer and similar, he hopes, to the type used in the Kinnear household and purloined by James McDermott. He hasn't yet produced it. It's in a wicker basket, a shopping basket actually borrowed from Dora, which he has placed unobtrusively by the side of his chair. He isn't entirely sure what he plans to do with it. Grace continues her stitching. She does not look up. "Nobody has cared about that before, sir," she says. "They told me I must be lying. They kept wanting to know more, except for Mr. Kenneth Mackenzie, the lawyer, but I'm sure that even he did not believe me." "I will believe you," says Simon. It is, he realizes, a fairly large undertaking. Grace tightens her mouth a little, frowns, says nothing. He plunges in. "Mr. Kinnear left for the city on the Thursday, did he not?" "Yes, sir," says Grace. "At 3 o'clock, on horseback." "That was the exact time, sir. He was to be back on the Saturday. I was outside, sprinkling the linen handkerchiefs laid out in the sun to bleach. McDermott brought the horse round for him. Mr. Kinnear was riding Charlie as the wagon was down in the village getting a fresh coat of paint put on it."
"Did he say anything to you at that time?"
"He said, 'Here's your favorite beau, Grace, come and kiss him goodbye.'" "Meaning James McDermott?" "But McDermott was not going anywhere," says Simon. Grace looks up at him with a blank expression which verges on contempt.
"He meant the horse, sir. He knew I was very fond of Charlie."
"And what did you do?"
"I went over and stroked Charlie, sir, on the nose.
But Nancy was watching from the winter kitchen door, and she'd heard what he said and did not like it. Nor did McDermott, but there was no harm in it. Mr. Kinnear only enjoyed a tease." Simon takes a deep breath. "Had Mr. Kinnear ever made improper advances to you, Grace?" She looks at him again. This time there's a faint smile.
"I don't know what you mean by improper, sir. He never used foul language to me."
"Did he ever touch you? Did he take liberties?"
"Only what was usual, sir."
"Usual?" says Simon. He is baffled. He does not know how to say what he means without being too explicit. Grace has a strong dash of prude in her.
"With a servant, sir."
"He was a kind enough master," says Grace primly, "and liberal when he wished to be." Simon lets his impatience get the better of him. What does she mean? Is she saying she got paid for favors? "Did he put his hands inside your clothing?" he says. "Were you lying down?" Grace stands up.
"I have heard enough of that kind of talk," she says. "I do not have to stay here. You are just like them at the asylum and the prison chaplains and Dr. Bannerling and his filthy ideas."
Simon finds himself apologizing to her and no wiser into the bargain. "Please sit down," he says when she has been soothed. "Let us go back to the chain of events. Mr. Kinnear rode away at 3 o'clock on Thursday. Then what happened?"
"Nancy said we was both to leave after the next day, and she had the money to pay us. She said that Mr. Kinnear was in agreement with her."
"Did you believe that?"
"As regards McDermott, I did, but not as regards myself."
"Not yourself," says Simon. "She was afraid that Mr. Kinnear would come to like me better than her. As I've said, sir, she was in the family way, and it often happens like that with a man. They'll change from a woman in that condition to one who is not, and it's the same with cows and horses. And if that happened, she'd be out on the road, her and her bastard. It was plain she wanted me out of the way and gone before Mr. Kinnear came home. I don't believe he knew a thing about it."
"What did you do then, Grace?"
"I cried, sir.
In the kitchen.
I did not want to leave, and I had no new situation to go to. It had been so sudden, I'd had no time to seek for one. And I was afraid she would not pay me after all and send me off with no reference, and then what would I do? And McDermott feared the same."
"And then," says Simon, when she does not continue,
"it was at this time, sir, that McDermott said he had a secret, and I promised not to tell. And you know, sir, that once having promised such a thing, I was bound by it. Then he said he was going to kill Nancy with the axe, and strangle her as well,
and shoot Mr. Kinnear when he came back and take the valuables, and I was to help him and go with him if I knew what was good for me, as otherwise I would be blamed for all. If I hadn't been so upset, I would have laughed at him. But I did not. And to tell you the truth, we'd both had a glass or two of Mr. Kinnear's whiskey, which we saw no reason not to help ourselves, seeing as we were to be turned away in any case. Nancy was over to the rights, and so we had a free hand. Did you believe McDermott would do as he said? Not altogether, sir. On the one hand, I thought he was just bragging about what a fine man he was and what he could do, which was the thing he was prone to when drunk, and my father was the same way. But at the same time, he seemed in earnest, and I was afraid of him. And I had a strong feeling as if it was fated and couldn't be avoided no matter what I did. You did not warn anyone, Nancy herself, when she came back from her visit? Why would she have believed me, sir? Says Grace. It would have sounded too stupid if I said it out loud. She would think I was getting back at her because she told me to leave, or that it was a servant's quarrel and I was paying back McDermott. There was only my word for it, which he could easily deny and say I was nothing but a silly, hysterical girl. At the same time, if McDermott really meant it, he might have killed the both of us right there and then, and I did not want to be killed. The best I could do was to try to delay him until Mr. Kinnear got back. At first he said he was going to do it that very night, but I persuaded him not to. How did you manage to do that? Says Simon. I said that if Nancy was killed on the Thursday, that would mean a whole day and a half of having to account for her whereabouts to anyone who might inquire, whereas if he left it till later, there would be less suspicion aroused. I see, says Simon. Very sensible. Please don't make fun of me, sir, says Grace with dignity. It is very distressing to me, and doubly so considering what I'm being asked to remember. Simon says he didn't mean it that way. He seems to be spending a lot of time apologizing to her. And what happened then? He asks, trying to sound kind and not too eager. Then Nancy came back from her visit and was quite cheerful. It was always her way after she'd been in a temper to pretend as if nothing had happened, and we were all the best of friends, at least when Mr. Kinnear was not present. So she acted as if she hadn't told us to leave or given us any hard words, and all went on as usual. We had supper together in the kitchen, cold ham and potatoes made into a salad with chives from the garden, the three of us, and she laughed and chattered. McDermott was sullen and silent, but that was no change. And then Nancy and I went to bed together, as was always the case when Mr. Kinnear was away, on account of her fear of burglars, and she suspected nothing. What did you do then, Grace?
I cried, sir.
In the kitchen. I did not want to leave, and I had no new situation to go to. It had been so sudden, I'd had no time to seek for one. And I was afraid she would not pay me after all and send me off with no reference, and then what would I do? And McDermott feared the same. And then, says Simon, when she does not continue, it was at this time, sir, that McDermott said he had a secret, and I promised not to tell. And you know, sir, that once having promised such a thing, I was bound by it. Then he said he was going to kill Nancy with the axe, and strangle her as well, and shoot Mr. Kinnear when he came back and take the valuables, and I was to help him and go with him if I knew what was good for me, as otherwise I would be blamed for all. If I hadn't been so upset, I would have laughed at him. But I did not. And to tell you the truth, we'd both had a glass or two of Mr. Kinnear's whiskey, which we saw no reason not to help ourselves, seeing as we were to be turned away in any case. Nancy was over to the rights, and so we had a free hand. Did you believe McDermott would do as he said? Not altogether, sir. On the one hand, I thought he was just bragging about what a fine man he was and what he could do, which was the thing he was prone to when drunk, and my father was the same way. But at the same time, he seemed in earnest, and I was afraid of him. And I had a strong feeling as if it was fated, and couldn't be avoided no matter what I did. You did not warn anyone, Nancy herself, when she came back from her visit? Why would she have believed me, sir? Says Grace. It would have sounded too stupid if I said it out loud. She would think I was getting back at her because she told me to leave, or that it was a servant's quarrel and I was paying back McDermott. There was only my word for it, which he could easily deny and say I was nothing but a silly, hysterical girl. At the same time, if McDermott really meant it, he might have killed the both of us right there and then, and I did not want to be killed. The best I could do was to try to delay him until Mr. Kinnear got back. At first he said he was going to do it that very night, but I persuaded him not to.
How did you manage to do that? Says Simon.
I said that if Nancy was killed on the Thursday, that would mean a whole day and a half of having to account for her whereabouts to anyone who might inquire, whereas if he left it till later, there would be less suspicion aroused.
I see, says Simon. Very sensible.
Please don't make fun of me, sir, says Grace with dignity. It is very distressing to me, and doubly so considering what I'm being asked to remember.
Simon says he didn't mean it that way. He seems to be spending a lot of time apologizing to her.
And what happened then? He asks, trying to sound kind and not too eager.
Then Nancy came back from her visit and was quite cheerful. It was always her way after she'd been in a temper to pretend as if nothing had happened, and we were all the best of friends, at least when Mr. Kinnear was not present. So she acted as if she hadn't told us to leave, or given us any hard words, and all went on as usual. We had supper together in the kitchen. Cold ham and potatoes made into a salad with chives from the garden, the three of us. And she laughed and chattered. McDermott was sullen and silent, but that was no change. And then Nancy and I went to bed together, as was always the case when Mr. Kinnear was away, on account of her fear of burglars, and she suspected nothing. But I made very sure the bedchamber door was locked.
Why was that?
As I've said, I always lock the door when I sleep. But also McDermott had some foolish notion of creeping about the house at night with the axe. He wanted to kill Nancy while asleep. I said he should not do that, as he might hit me by mistake, but it was hard to convince him. He said he didn't want her looking at him when he did it.
I can understand that, says Simon dryly.
And then what happened?
Oh, the Friday began right as rain to the outward eye, sir. Nancy was very gay and light-hearted and did not scold at all, or not as much as usual. And even McDermott was less sullen in the morning, as I told him if he went around with such a hangdog face, then Nancy was sure to suspect he was up to no good. In the middle of the afternoon, young Jamie Walsh came over with his flute, as Nancy had asked him to. She said that as Mr. Kinnear was away, we would all have a party to celebrate. What was to be celebrated, I'm not sure, but in her good mood, Nancy was very lively and liked a song and dance. We had a fine supper, with cold roast chicken and beer to wash it down, and then Nancy told Jamie to play for us, and he asked me if there was a tune I would especially wish to have, and was very attentive and kind to me, which McDermott did not like, and told him to stop making sheep's eyes at me, as it was enough to turn the stomach, and poor Jamie flushed bright red. Then Nancy told McDermott not to tease the boy, and couldn't he remember being young once himself? And she told Jamie he would grow up handsome, she could always tell a thing like that, much handsomer than McDermott, with his scowling and pouting, and in any case, handsome is as handsome does. And McDermott threw her a look of pure hate, which she affected not to see. Then she sent me down into the cellar to get more whiskey, as by that time we had emptied the decanters upstairs. Then we laughed and sang, or Nancy laughed and sang, and I joined in. We sang The Rose of Tralee, and I remembered Mary Whitney, and wished very much that she was there, as she would know what to do, and would help me out of my difficulties. McDermott would not sing, as the dark mood was on him. Nor would he dance when Nancy urged him, and said now was his chance to make good his boasts about what a nimble dancer he was. She wanted us all to part friends, but he was having none of that. After a time, the life went out of the party. Jamie said he was tired of playing, and Nancy said it was time for bed. And McDermott said he would walk Jamie back to his own house across the fields, I suppose to make sure he was well and truly gone. But by the time McDermott was come back, Nancy and I were upstairs already in Mr. Kinnear's room, with the door locked.
Mr. Kinnear's room? Says Simon.
It was Nancy's idea,
says Grace. She said his bed was bigger and cooler in the hot weather, and I had a habit of kicking in my sleep, and in any case Mr. Kinnear would not find it out, as it was us who made up the beds, not him. And even if he did discover it, he would not care, but would no doubt like the idea of two serving maids in his bed at once. She had drunk several glasses of whiskey and was talking recklessly. And I did warn Nancy after all, sir. While she was brushing out her hair, I said, McDermott wants to kill you. She laughed, and I said, I expect he does. I would not mind killing him either. There is no love lost between us. He is in earnest, I said. He is never in earnest about anything, she said lightly. He is always bragging and boasting, and it is all just air. So then I knew there was nothing I could do to save her. Once she was in bed, she fell asleep at once. I sat brushing out my own hair in the light of a single candle, with the naked woman in the picture looking out at me, the one who was taking a bath outdoors, and the other one with the peacock feathers. And they were both smiling at me in a way I did not like. That night, Mary Whitney appeared to me in a dream. It was not the first time. She'd come before, but never to say anything. She would be hanging up the wash and laughing, or paring an apple, or hiding behind a sheet on the line up in the attic, which were all things she used to do before her trouble came. And when I dreamt about her in that way, I would wake up comforted, as if she was still alive and happy. But those were scenes of the past. This time, she was in the room with me, the very room where I was, which was Mr. Kinnear's bedchamber. She was standing beside the bed in her nightdress, with her hair down, as when she was buried, and on the left side of her body I could see her heart, bright red, through the white of her dress. But then I saw it was not a heart, after all, but the red felt needle case I made for her that Christmas, which I'd put in the coffin with her, under the flowers and the scattered petals. And I was glad to see she still had it with her and hadn't forgotten me. She was holding a glass tumbler in her hand, and inside it was a firefly. Trapped and glowing was a cold and greenish fire. Her face was very pale, but she looked at me and smiled, and then she took her hand from the top of the glass, and the firefly came out and darted about the room, and I knew that this was her soul, and it was trying to find its way out, but the window was shut, and then I could not see where it was gone. Then I woke up with the tears of sadness running down my face, because Mary was lost to me once more. I lay there in the darkness, with the sound of Nancy's breathing, and in my ears I could hear my own heart trudging and trudging, as if on a long and weary road that I was doomed to walk along whether I wanted to or not, and who could tell when I would get to the end of it. I was afraid to go to sleep again for fear I might have another such dream, and my fears were not in vain, for that is indeed what happened. In this new dream, I dreamt I was walking in a place I'd never been before, with high walls all around made of stone, grey and bleak as the stones of the village where I was born, back across on the other side of the ocean. On the ground there were loose grey pebbles, and out of the gravel there were peonies growing. They came up with just the buds on them, small and hard like unripe apples. And then they opened, and there were huge dark red flowers with glossy petals, like satin, and then they burst in the wind and fell to the ground. Except for being red, they were like the peonies in the front garden on the first day when I came to Mr. Kinnear's, when Nancy was cutting the last of them. And I saw her in the dream just as she was then, in her pale dress with the pink rosebuds and the triple-flounced skirt, and her straw bonnet that hid her face. She was carrying a flat basket to put the flowers in, and then she turned and put her hand up to her throat as if startled. Then I was back in the stone yard, walking, with the toes of my shoes going in and out under the hem of my skirt, which was blue and white stripes. I knew I'd never had a skirt like that before, and at the sight of it I felt a great heaviness and desolation. But the peonies were still coming up from the stones, and I knew they shouldn't be there. I reached out my hand to touch one, and it had a dry feel, and I knew it was made of cloth. Then up ahead I saw Nancy on her knees, with her hair fallen over and the blood running down into her eyes. Around her neck was a white cotton kerchief printed with blue flowers, love in a mist, and it was mine. She was holding out her hands to me for mercy. In her ears were the little gold earrings I used to envy. I wanted to run to her and help her, but I could not. And my feet kept walking at the same steady pace as though they were not my own feet at all. When I was almost up to Nancy, to where she was kneeling, she smiled. Only the mouth. Her eyes were hidden by the blood and hair. And then she came apart into patches of color. She scattered a drift of red and white cloth petals across the stones. Then it was dark suddenly, and a man was standing there with a candle, blocking the stairs that went up, and the cellar walls were all around me, and I knew I would never get out. "You dreamt this before the event?" says Simon. He is writing feverishly. "Yes, sir," says Grace. "And many times since." Her voice has dropped to a whisper. "That was why they put me away." "Away?" Simon prompts. "Into the asylum, sir. Because of the bad dreams." She has laid her sewing aside and is looking down at her hands. "Only the dreams?" Simon asks gently. "They said they were not dreams at all, sir. They said I was awake. But I do not wish to say any more about it." On the Saturday morning, I woke up at dawn. Outside, in the henhouse, the cock was crowing. He had a hoarse and rattling sort of crow, as if there was a hand tightening around his neck already, and I thought, "You know you're for the stewpot soon. Soon you will be a carcass." And although I was thinking about the rooster, I will not deny that I was thinking about Nancy as well. It sounds cold, and perhaps it is. I felt light-headed and detached from myself, as if I was not really present, but only there in body. I know these are odd thoughts to confess to, sir, but I will not lie and conceal them, as I could easily do, having never told this to anyone before. I wish to relate everything just as it happened to me. And those were the thoughts I had. Nancy was still asleep, and I took care not to disturb her. I felt she might as well have her sleep out, and the longer she stayed in bed, the longer it would be before anything bad happened, either to her or to me. As I crept cautiously out of Mr. Kinnear's bed, she groaned and rolled over, and I wondered whether she was having a bad dream. The night previous, I'd put my nightdress on in my own room, off the winter kitchen, before going upstairs with my candle, so I went in there and dressed as usual. Everything was the same, but not the same. And when I went to wash my face and do my hair, my own face in the mirror over the kitchen sink was not like my face at all. It looked rounder and whiter, with two great, startled, staring eyes, and I didn't wish to look at it. I went into the kitchen and opened the window shutters. The glasses and plates from the night before were still on the table, and they looked very lonely and forlorn, as if some great and sudden disaster had overtaken all who had eaten and drunk from them. And here was I, coming upon them by accident, many years later, and I felt very sad. I gathered them up and carried them into the scullery. When I came back out, there was a strange light in the kitchen, as if there was a film of silver over everything, like frost, only smoother, like water running thinly down over flat stones. And then my eyes were opened, and I knew it was because God had come into the house, and this was the silver that covered heaven. God had come in because God is everywhere. You can't keep him out. He is a part of everything there is, so how could you ever build a wall, or four walls, or a door, or a shut window, that he could not walk right through as if it was air? I said, "What do you want here?" But he did not answer, he just kept on being silver. So I went out to milk the cow, because the only thing to do about God is to go on with what you're doing anyway, since you can't ever stop him or get any reasons out of him. There is a do this or a do that with God, but not any because. When I came back with the pails of milk, I saw McDermott in the kitchen. He was cleaning the shoes. "Where is Nancy?" he said. "She is dressing," I said. "Are you going to kill her this morning?" "Yes," he said. "Damn her. I will take the axe now and go and knock her on the head." I laid my hand on his arm and looked up into his face. "Surely you will not, surely you cannot bring yourself to do such a wicked thing," I said. But he didn't understand me. He thought I was taunting him. He thought I was calling him a coward. "You will see in a minute what I can do," he said angrily. "Oh, for God's sake, don't kill her in the room," I said. "You will make the floor all bloody." It was a foolish thing to say, but that is what came into my mind, and as you know, sir, it was my job to clean the floors in that house, and there was a carpet in Nancy's room. I'd never tried to get blood out of a carpet, but I got it out of other things, and it is not a task to be sneezed at. McDermott gave me a scornful glance as if I was a half-wit, and indeed I must have sounded like one. Then he went outside the house and picked up the axe from beside the chopping block. I could not think what to do. I went into the garden to gather some chives, as Nancy had ordered an omelette for breakfast. On the bolted lettuces, the snails were making their lacework. I knelt down and watched them, with their eyes on little stems. And I reached out my hand for the chives, and it was as if my hand was not mine at all, but only a husk or skin, with inside it another hand growing. I tried to pray, but the words would not come, and I believe that is because I had ill-wished Nancy. I had indeed wished her dead, but I did not do so right then. But why did I need to pray when God was right there, hovering above us like the angel of death over the Egyptians? I could feel his cold breath. I could hear the beating of his dark wings inside my heart. God is everywhere, I thought. So God is in the kitchen, and God is in Nancy, and God is in McDermott, and in McDermott's hands, and God is in the axe, too. Then I heard a dull sound from within, like a heavy door closing shut. And after that, I can remember no more for a time. "Nothing about the cellar," says Simon. "Not about seeing McDermott dragging Nancy by the hair to the trap door and throwing her down the stairs? It was in your confession." Grace clutches her two hands to the sides of her head. "That is what they wanted me to say. Mr. Mackenzie told me I had to say it to save my own life." For once she is trembling. "He said it was not a lie, as that is what must have happened, whether I could remember it or not." "Did you give James McDermott the kerchief from around your neck?" Simon sounds more like a courtroom lawyer than he wishes to, but he presses on. "The one that was used to strangle poor Nancy?" "It was mine, I know that, but I have no recollection of giving it to him." "Nor of being down in the cellar?" says Simon. "Nor of helping him to kill her? Nor of wanting to steal the gold earrings off the corpse, as he says you wish to do?" Grace covers her eyes with a hand briefly. "All that time is dark to me, sir," she says. "And in any case, there were no gold earrings taken. I won't say I didn't think of it later when we were packing up. But having a thought is not the same as doing it. If we were all on trial for our thoughts, we would all be hanged." Simon has to admit the justice of this. He tries a different line. "Jefferson, the butcher, testified that he spoke with you that morning." "I know he did, sir. But I cannot remember it." "He says he was surprised, as it was not you who ordinarily gave the orders, but Nancy. And he was further surprised when you said that no fresh meat was wanted for the week. He found it most peculiar.
If it was me, sir, and acting in my right mind, I'd have had my wits about me and ordered the meat as usual. It would have been less suspicious.
Simon has to agree.
Well then, he says, what is the next thing?